Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show Friday Drive Time with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. What's the son of the US Secret Service man who helped the Nazis escape the gallows in 1945 been up to in Egypt? American Frank Wisner was the OSS officer, the predecessors to the CIA, who sprung Nazi war criminals from jail because he wanted them to help the USA fight the Cold War. So what's his son, Frank Wisner Jr., been up to in Egypt? At least 650 supporters of democratically elected President Morsi are now known to have been killed and 4,500 injured in Wednesday's Raba massacre. But Wisner describes this as inevitable. So we get the USSS line on Egypt straight from the horse's mouth. And as we see more attacks on Coptic Christian churches, we ask, were these bombs planted by the Egyptian government's own interior ministry, as they were at the beginning of the Arab Spring under Mubarak? And how independent are London think tanks Chatham House and the Royal United Services Institute on all of this? Moving to another part of the Middle East, what about the diabolical mess Bush and Blair left after our government's last illegal war in Iraq? Is the US occupation still going on? And what's being done about the continuing birth defects? Surely this is a concern of the World Health Organization. If not, why not? We hear from local author and depleted uranium expert Joe Baker. Zero-hour contracts. After the last month, we've seen the government raise the number of people they thought were on these contracts from 150,000 to over a million. Can we trust employment statistics? And more importantly, what are your legal rights when your boss tells you you're onto one of these new contracts? Or if you're already on one? Plus, in case you thought our condemned government supported the free press, broadcasts from around the world now banned. This week we hear from Syrian television. Also, who's training Colombia's torturers? Tobias Tayani's finishes last week's eye-opening dispatch from the heart of the Colombian jungle. So, Martin, we start this week quite clearly from Wednesday and the massacre in Cairo. What are your initial thoughts about what was behind this?
Well, obviously, like everybody else, I'm trying to assess what's happening. I'm just reading the news reports. The real danger, of course, is that we're moving towards civil war in Egypt. And obviously, you know, in Syria at this stage, people took up arms against the government with the encouragement of the West. So are the Western powers now going to encourage the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt to take up arms against the government? And will the RAF be bombing the Egyptian army's tanks as they did in Libya?
Well, one person who thinks that this whole thing was inevitable is this chap, Frank Wisner, I mentioned at the top of the hour. He is Frank Wisner Jr., in fact, and he's father was behind the OSS operation called Operation Paperclip. He was the officer in charge of that operation. Martin, just refresh our memories. What was Operation Paperclip?
Well, if people put Operation Paperclip into a search engine, they will find a Wikipedia article or whatever which will tell them what it is. Basically, at the end of the war, large numbers of senior Nazis were recruited by the Western intelligence services to fight the communists. Classic example being Reinhard Gehlen, who is the head of the Gestapo in Eastern Europe, who ends up running the BND, the West German intelligence services.
But then what they were also doing was actually springing people from jail who were due to go on trial. People were being, jailers were coming to the jail, so they found, well, where's that guy gone? Well, Wisner was one of the people behind springing them from jail and actually getting them out and over to the United States. But why was it that the United States was so interested in getting these people out? And because these were war criminals.
Well, yes, but I mean, in the case of Reinhard Gehlen, he simply went to the OSS and MI6 and said, look, I've got all these agents inside communist Soviet Union, which I've been running for the last few years for Hitler. Do you want them? Because if you do, then I will join with you and you can have them. And as long as you don't punish me. And not only did they not punish him, they put him in charge of the West German intelligence services, which sent a very clear message to the Russians, of course.
Okay, so let's have a listen now to Frank Wisner Jr., who was ambassador to Egypt from the United States for several years, and also an unofficial advisor after that. See what he's got to say about the Wednesday's horrific massacre of the army and associated forces, killed over 600 people and injured something like 2,400.
The Muslim Brothers, after 6 weeks of negotiation, were not going to cede any serious political ground, and the government, backed by the military, were not going to surrender their place and give in to the demands that the Muslim Brothers had put before them. It was not possible to carry on with the city tied up in knots, and so finally, though one wished it didn't have to happen and regrets the violence, I believe that this was inevitable.
Well, I mean, you can see what's being said here. In Syria at this stage, people like Wisner were saying, oh, look at this terrible Assad, he's killing his own people, they're fighting back, who can blame them? That's what they were saying in Syria. In Egypt, different story, eh?
He's saying that the Muslim Brotherhood was just simply failing to negotiate over a space of more than a month.
Well, what the Muslim Brotherhood was saying was, we want our man restored and then we'll talk. And of course, there was always another option. Don't forget, these protest camps have been there for 6 weeks. They were, you know, why not let them carry on? I mean, even if you are the government, an illegitimate government that's not there on the basis of any kind of election, you don't have to actually kill everybody or make their camps go away. Let them have their camps. Why do you need to move against them?
You will obviously regret the violence, but it is extremely important to remember that Egypt is of central strategic significance to the United States. This is not an easy passage. We don't look forward to violence, but we have to also look to our national interests, and they are maintaining a close dialogue with Egypt, using that dialogue to try to promote a return to democracy, use that dialogue to improve economic conditions in the country, and to have foreign policy objectives that are in sync with Egypt's overall direction. No one wanted this to happen the way it is, but the overall national interest calls on us to work with Egypt and to see this new government settle down, stabilized, and Egypt back on the path to democracy.
Well, I mean, it just says it all, doesn't it? It's our interests that we're talking about here, not the people of Egypt's interest. They simply don't enter into the equation.
It's Americans are saying it's a key strategic interest.
Well, it is, and that's what's called imperialism. And what imperialism leads to is war. And of course, the only good news probably is that the US Army and Navy and Air Force have been beaten in Afghanistan, beaten in Iraq, and the Egyptian Army will ultimately probably be beaten in Egypt.
Well, tell us about the faction that he represents in the United States.
The faction that he represents? Well, I mean, we're trying to work out where the United States is on this issue is quite complicated.
I mean, isn't it clear that a green light has been given probably by the Britain and the US?
Yep.
Because all they've done is they've said that we think this is terrible, but they haven't actually acted. The supply of money to the Egyptian military is carrying
absolutely,
on regardless.
Absolutely. At the same time, don't forget, what the imperialist powers want is to control Egypt. So they've got loads of infiltrators inside the Muslim Brotherhood. The Muslim Brotherhood, in fact, has been heavily infiltrated by Western intelligence services for over 100 years. I mean, it was set up in many ways by the British in order to undermine secular nationalists like Nasser, and that Nasser repressed the Muslim Brotherhood because he saw it as a fifth column for the Western powers. But at the same time, of course, they supply all the weaponry which is being used on the people now to the Egyptian government. Now, I'll just repeat what I said earlier. In Libya and Syria at this stage, the Western powers said that the ordinary folk were justified in taking up arms against the government. And if it was what's good for Libya and what's good for Syria, maybe it's good for Egypt. Now, get me clear, the Muslim Brothers have actually called for peaceful protests. They have not called for violence. But if they were to call for violence, that would be exactly the same as the Free Syrian Army and the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, wouldn't it?
The United States has tried to play a role as mediator to avoid the outbreak of violence, to seek a political solution. The violence that is occurring today is violence that is coming from a number of different directions. But a responsible government is, when pressed, and after having exhausted other political means, have to move to restore law and order. I believe that it would have been infinitely preferable had there been a political settlement. But after 6 weeks of negotiations, I could see the prospects of reaching a political settlement diminishing.
Well, I mean, President Assad has welcomed the takeover in Egypt because he sees it as analogous to his own situation. I've got a minority, he would say a minority of Sunni Muslim extremists in my society. I mean, I've also got people coming in from outside, from Libya, for example, who are causing all sorts of problems. And I'm a responsible government. I can't allow these people to go around blowing things up. I mean, the Free Syrian Army murdered several hundred Kurds this week, which we haven't heard about on our media, but it's been on the world's media. A responsible government like Assad just can't allow that to go on. He's got to keep control. The same goes for the Egyptian army, eh?
Now, this Frank Wisner interview was aired on the BBC WGBH Boston programme, which, as far as I know, I think it's syndicated across the US, and it's called The World. The interviewer was Marco Weimann. So let's hear a listen to the last clip now from Frank Wisner Jr.
We just spoke with a Canadian woman married to an Egyptian. She's in Cairo. She was periodically supporting the democratic process by camping in solidarity with the demonstrators. She told me her worst fear is that Egypt now turns into Syria. Do you think that could happen?
I don't think the situation is comparable, neither in the history of the country nor the ethnicities and religious composition, nor in the narrowly based government structure that Syria represents. I don't believe that's the case. Obviously, we're in the eye of the storm, but I have a sense that Egypt's core instincts are to move back towards stability and a democratic expression. I believe that that is possible, but the tone of your question implies that Egypt teeters on the verge of chaos, and that I find rather far-fetched.
Well, it's interesting that he himself has drawn the analogy with Syria. NATO themselves carried out a report and study inside Syria which suggested that 70% of the population of Syria supported the Assad regime. In actual fact, in Egypt, it's a 50-50 split. The Muslim Brothers did win 60% of the vote at the recent elections. Now, of course, they've got authoritarian tendencies as well. But I think it's very significant, is it not, that they are happy to see the Egyptian army crack down on the ordinary folk of Egypt, but when Assad or Gaddafi does the same thing in their countries, they're evil tyrants that have to go, have to be put up against a wall and shot, basically. And ultimately, what may happen with the Muslim Brotherhood is they may decide to go to armed struggle, as the FIS did in Algeria in the 90s. Up to 1 million people died during that.
I mean, this is the big question, isn't it? I mean, we're going to have an election, another election, and if so, is it possible that the Muslim Brotherhood may be elected with an even bigger majority?
Well, quite possibly after all this repression, but in actual fact there is actually an election in Syria penciled in for 2014, and there's actually penciled in. It isn't penciled in yet in Egypt, is it?
Okay, now I'm joined in the studio by Joe Baker, looking at a little bit further back at another war, but the thing is, the war has lingered on, Joe. Hi, and welcome to Drive Time.
Yes, hi there.
Now, you've been having a look at what's been going on in Iraq, particularly to do with this horrific issue of birth defects. Just tell us about what you found out and about your book.
Yeah, well, actually, I'd like to go back even further in time. I'd like to go back to Japan in 1945, and it was what's becoming clear is there's some strong similarities between what was happening in Japan then and what's happening in Iraq today. And in fact, some of the surveys that have been done recently are showing that the incidence of birth defects and cancers are actually worse in parts of Iraq than they were in the aftermath of Hiroshima. So, and I think also what's happening, it's very clear that Iraqi doctors have been forbidden to speak out at all or to give any figures. This also happened in Japan when they were allowed to admit to the acute effects of radiation, but the longer term chronic illnesses were not allowed to be talked about. The Japanese government, in fact, was also not allowed to give social care to any of these people. And this was going on for many years during the US occupation. And the Iraqi government is in a very similar position today. I think many of them would like to talk, to speak out about what's actually happening. But they also have written to many of the doctors, especially in Fallujah, saying that they must absolutely not speak to journalists, not to give any figures. And they are also concerned that the that since 2011, where most of the American troops actually withdrew into Kuwait, that the embassy in Iraq, which is the largest in the world, it still has 16,000 US staff there, but there's no real agreement with the Iraqi government about what, you know, what their whole sort of purpose is. I mean, 5,000 of those are definitely security contractors.
Okay, so the army's gone, so but the private security has moved in.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So, and what's interesting is that what's been happening with the birth defects and cancers. I mean, the stories have been coming out, and scientists have been trying to actually find out exactly what's going on, and there has been a steady pressure building up, and that pressure has eventually got to the World Health Organization, and they set up a study in May-June 2012 together with the Iraqi Ministry of Health. And they said at the time that they were absolutely definitively not going to look at any link between birth defects and DU in the country, because many people had asked them to do this, but they said they weren't going to do that. But they have done this study, and it is quite a broad study. It's involved 10,800 households over 18 districts in Iraq. And really they have just been seeing just what the actual incidence of the birth defects is over the whole of Iraq. It's been from Basra to Baghdad to Mosul to Nineveh, everywhere. So it's been quite a broad study. And this study was completed in October 2012. And we were told that it would be released in November 2012. Now, this is, we're now in August 2013, and there's no sign of this study being released. And so many people are beginning to question this and want to know why, because it's a very serious study. We need to know the results of it. Quite recently, 58 scientists and human rights advocates, including Chomsky and Ken Loach, in fact, have actually written to the WHO, you know, saying that this is really not acceptable, and this study must be released now.
Yeah, I mean, what reasons have the World Health Organization given for not publishing it?
Yeah.
I mean, surely if you're going to do this kind of thing and the world is going to learn from what is a terrible, terrible experience, and particularly bad, because this is something that carries on through generations, you know, genetic damage to fathers and mothers and to the children that are growing up. What excuse have they given?
I don't think they're giving any excuse at all. I just don't think there's anything much being said. It just isn't appearing. And the Iraqi Ministry of Health actually, I think, does want to speak out. And it was interesting, in March of this year, there was a BBC report. A journalist went over to speak to quite a high-ranking official in the Iraqi ministry. And he was sort of leaking that that the results are quite horrendous, of very, very high percentages, and that the worst ones are most definitely in the parts of Iraq, in Anbar, in Najaf, where we know there was a lot of US munitions used during the fighting, especially in 2003-2004. So there does seem to be a correlation, and maybe this is the reason that the report is not being released.
Now, the World Health Organization have suppressed this report for the time being, but what do we know about the extent of birth defects?
There was a study done by Chris Busby, which shows that, well, I think the results of his study actually showed that it is. That I think it was done in Fallujah, and it showed that 15% of all births have serious birth defects. And there's also, what isn't counted in that is the stillbirths, the miscarriages. Many women not able to conceive in the first place, and certainly not all the births are in fact recorded, so it could actually be statistically higher than that. And that is higher than what was happening in Japan, as I said, after the atomic bombs.
Now, Martin, this is particularly horrific. It's almost a double war crime, isn't it? I mean, the war was a criminal adventure in the first place. Bush and Blair going to it, these people both walking the streets, unbelievably. And now it seems that there is this poisonous legacy which is going through the genetic material of the Iraqi people into the indefinite future. Not surprising in some ways that the World Health Organization is scared to release this report, because it's going to draw even more attention to the crime.
Yes, and one has to wonder what sort of pressures there are inside the World Health Organization that allow it not to produce a report not to publish a report that it's commissioned. And it makes one question what the United Nations organizations are and who actually runs them.
Okay, Joe, your book is called Uranium in Iraq, The Poisonous Legacy of the Iraq Wars, published by Van der Plas Publishing. What are your thoughts on whether this World Health Organization report is actually finally going to be published?
Well, I assume there will be an enormous build-up of pressure, and I would really like your listeners, if they go online to our website, which is HTTP, and it's childvictimsofwar.org.uk. That's childvictimsofwar.org.uk. And on the home page, there is a link. And if you go on that link, you can sign the petition there. So I would be very grateful if anybody could actually do that.
Well, I'll do that. And also, yeah. we have our own program's own little webpage, which is www.thisweek.org.uk. And so when I get home this evening, I'll put a link up to your site from there if people want to go to thisweek.org.uk, or else you can go straight to childvictimsofwar.org.uk. So Joe Baker, author of Uranium in Iraq, The Poisonous Legacy of the Iraq Wars, and campaigner, fearless campaigner for the rights of mums, children, and also not to be polluted by this depleted uranium. Thanks very much for joining us this evening.
Thank you.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
Now, Martin, we've also heard what the West has given to Syria's rebels. Kim Sengupta in the Independent, of course, he is what he writes for. So far, the UK has sent around £8 million worth of non-lethal aid, according to official papers seen by the Independent, comprising of 4x4 vehicles with ballistic protection, 20 sets of body armour, 4 trucks, 3 25-tonne trucks, 1 20-tonne truck, 6 more 4x4s, SUVs, 5 sets of body armour, etc, etc. So we're starting to get a handle on exactly what's being given to the Syrian rebels. And this, I suppose, contrasts really with the actions on what's been going on over in Egypt. So what does this tell us about Syria?
Well, this is what the UK is admitting to giving to the Syrian rebels.
Ah.
If you actually look on the international media, you will see that they've been supplying the Benghazi incident, if you remember, where the US ambassador died in mysterious circumstances. It's all over the US media. In actual fact, what was going there, they were running a CIA gun-running operation, so they were taking weaponry from Libya and supplying it to the rebels in Syria behind the scenes, like the Iran-Contra affair in the 80s. The Democratic Congress in the US had told the Reagan administration that it couldn't supply weaponry to the Contras, so they set up their own completely independent supply line for the Contras, funded by cocaine shipments into the United States. So when the British government says this is what we're officially giving the rebels, that's what they're officially giving the rebels. But it's well known that Qatar and Saudi Arabia are providing everything from handheld missiles to Milan anti-tank stuff. basically the West has been supplying the rebels all. How do the rebels fight? I mean,
they're able to fight
because they've been supplied with weapons.
Well, you're saying that the NATO, the Israelis, Americans are working hand in hand with the mafia.
Well, it's not that they work with the mafia, but they also work with.
Are they actually smuggling the drugs in?
That was in the 1980s. They were working with the mafia. Yes, of course. But I mean, they work with mafias all the time. If you go to Sybil Edmonds' website, Boiling Frog, she used to work for the FBI as a translator. She talks about Gladio 2, and in Turkey they have what they call the deep state, the Ergenekon state.
Well, they don't anymore. They just had the trial.
Some of them have been sent to prison. But in actual fact, what you find with Western foreign policy is you've got the official line, tut tut, isn't it terrible, the Egyptian government is killing all these people. And then the unofficial line, which is wink, wink, do what you like, lads, it's okay with us. And the same goes with the rebels in Syria. The most effective rebels in Syria are clearly the al-Nusra Front, who are supported by the Saudis, the Qataris, and it was reported in the Daily Express that British SAS are in there training them. Now, they neither confirm nor deny when British special forces are involved, as they didn't in Libya. But it's well known that the SAS were in Libya long before any kind of pretense that we were supporting the rebels was being admitted to. So, frankly, we're sticking our finger. I mean, Roland Dumas, who used to be the foreign minister of France, said that he was approached by the British before the Arab Spring, and the British said to him, "We are planning a rebellion in Syria. Do you want to get involved?" And he said, "No, thank you very much. I'm not going to say anything more about it." In fact, the French were involved. He says, "I don't want to talk about French involvement." So what that looks like, if Roland Dumas is correct, it was in Le Figaro, I think, or another major, is in actual fact that the British were plotting a rebellion in Syria before the Arab Spring. So the 100,000 dead are not, in fact, responsibility of Assad. They're the responsibility of the British government. They are the guilty parties.
Well, in case you thought the condemned government supported a free press, my favourite part of the week, broadcasts from around the world which are now banned. This week it's Syrian TV. And this never was on the old Freeview system, at least it wasn't so easily available here in Britain as Press TV was when that was banned by Ofcom. But Syrian TV has been banned by something called Eutelsat, which is this private company that owns a big satellite, one of whom the directors is the former Director General of the BBC, John Burt, who was involved in so much of the privatisation of the BBC back in the early 1990s. So let's hear now a little excerpt from Syrian TV, banned in the UK.
Our armed forces continue their national task in clearing the homeland of terrorism. The Israeli occupation authorities approved the establishment of 942 new settlement units in occupied Jerusalem. Ladies and gentlemen, good afternoon. The American Chief of Staff, General Martin Dempsey, has admitted that the Syrian opposition is under the control of the terrorists of Al-Qaeda organization and Jabhat al-Nusra. Dempsey's words were quoted by Israeli press and political sources following his meetings with Israeli officials during his current visit to occupied Palestine within a tour that also includes Jordan. Dempsey said the USA is watching what is happening in Syria through satellites and is worried over the control of the so-called Jabhat al-Nusra and Al-Qaeda organization over the armed oppositions in the country. Dempsey affirmed full coordination between the USA and Israel regarding their plans against Syria, adding that his country will not take any military step towards Syria except after coordination with Israel first.
Well, there you go, Martin. It's interesting to hear these little clips, isn't it? Mr. Dempsey apparently is making sure that he runs all of his plans past Benjamin Netanyahu and the Israelis before they do anything like potentially invading or attacking Syria directly.
Yes, well, I mean, it's fairly clear what is happening in the Middle East is that the lineaments of a world war are starting to appear. Who's going to be on what side and who's going to be fighting who? It's basically to do with the West's desire to dominate the region. In Bahrain, for example, the government there were about to there was about to be protests on the anniversary of the protests that took place there in the Arab Spring a couple of years ago, and they've been massively repressed by the Bahraini army and the Saudi army, which of course crossed the border into Bahrain, a bit like the invasion of Czechoslovakia. We don't hear much about that. I think basically the West double standards are creating a huge reservoir of anger and bitterness all over the world.
What about the way this is all interpreted? Because there are two organisations we frequently see on the BBC and other national media, particularly television. One is Chatham House, the Royal Institute for International Affairs, and the other one is the Royal United Services Institute, that's RUSI. What are these? I mean, they're not just think tanks, they're also funded, aren't they?
Well, they're funded mainly by corporations, I think, rather than by governments. And, of course, they link into things like the Trilateral Commission, the Council on Foreign Relations, and our old friends Bilderberg.
You know, it seems to me that there's a sort of network of these policy-making bodies which are actually better funded in many ways than the actual official Foreign Office, which is part of the government.
Yes, and, you know, you've got a similar setup in the US where you've got things like... you know, there's all sorts
of Council on Foreign Relations.
Yes, well, I
in
mentioned
the US,
those a moment ago. I mean, the amount of money that's chucked at steering us into wars. Don't forget that the BAE Systems, for example, who make private profits out of selling things like drones and bombs, they fund things like Chatham House to come up with ideas about new wars. You know, it's like marketing and PR.
Now, also related to all this in the Middle East, Gaza hospitals are facing a fuel shortage. So the health ministry, the Israeli regime has imposed land, aerial and naval blockade on the Gaza Strip. And this is also just been shut again by the Egyptian government. Now, this is one of the little side effects that we're seeing from what's been going on in Egypt and the military takeover, the coup and now military rule is again that the border crossings into Gaza are being closed. And they really are a lifeline, aren't they, for the people in what is increasingly being seen as just a prison camp?
Yeah, well, Hamas is aligned with... Hamas is, in fact, the Palestinian branch of the Muslim Brotherhood. So that's why they're being dealt with so severely there by the Egyptian army. Muslim Brotherhood, of course, are supporting the rebels in Syria. So Muslim Brotherhood rebel in Syria, good! Muslim Brotherhood rebel in Egypt, bad. You know, it's... it's like Alice in Wonderland, isn't it?
Another news story this week is actually from Saudi Arabia. And this is one I find absolutely incredible that it's got virtually no coverage over here. And that is the defection of a Saudi prince. Martin, what do you make of this? I mean, this is a chap called Prince Khalid bin Farham, and he's defected to Germany. He's saying that the Saudi government is scared of Arab revolts.
Well, it's not surprising. I mean, they're doing their best to try and crush them. I mean, they've supported the takeover in Egypt because they're no friends of the Muslim Brothers. And also, when I read about this prince, and he said they've got 30,000 political prisoners in Saudi Arabia. 30,000 political prisoners, probably being tortured. Is it about time we sent the RAF to bomb them and the Royal Marines to overthrow the government like we did in Iraq, like we did in Libya? Isn't it time to put these guys up against the wall and their allies? Oh, that would be the Western powers. That would be Obama and Cameron. Maybe they should have the same fate as Gaddafi, because they're against democracy, and democracy must triumph, no matter how much blood has to flow.
Well, what about this? Why is it, though, that we have not heard anything about this guy, Prince Khalid bin Farhan? I mean, if it's a prince, I mean, he's actually part of the royal family, and he's actually decided, no, I don't want anything more to do with the Saudi regime. We should be hearing what he's got to say.
We should, but don't forget that Filton, for example, gets a lot of overtime out of supplying weaponry to the Saudi regime. We don't want to rock that boat, do we?
Let's have a listen anyway now to Prince Khalid bin Farhan. I'm not sure which TV this is on. I'll tell you afterwards if I can.
The government is obviously scared of the Arab revolutions, and they've responded as they usually do,
by resorting to oppression, violence, arbitrary law, and arrest. The easiest thing they can do is deprive you of your salary or fire you altogether. The ruling regime is not guided by justice, and this is especially true of the Ministry of Interior. There is no independent judiciary, as both police and the prosecutor's office are accountable to the Interior Ministry. The ministry's officials investigate crimes, they call them crimes, related to freedom of speech. So they fabricate evidence, don't allow people to have attorneys. Things like that happen all over the place. They even put people under arrest for an indefinite amount of time. Even if a court rules to release such a criminal, the Ministry of Interior keeps him in prison, even though there is a court order to release him. There have even been killings. And as for the external opposition, Saudi intelligence forces find these people abroad. There is no safety inside or outside the country. Opposition used to demand wider people's representation in governing bodies, more rights and freedoms. But the authorities reacted with violence and persecution instead of a dialogue. Now the opposition wants this regime gone. The White House certainly does maintain a long-standing alliance with the leaders of Saudi Arabia, cemented by common interests in the Middle East. To that end, there are classified contacts between Riyadh and the U.S. administration. In recent time, they have been employed to step up the government-administered reforms. But those reforms are not driven by the elite's desire to empower the people of the kingdom. Instead, they are merely urged by reforms that the regime might fall unless it reforms itself. Oppression is widespread in Saudi Arabia. There is no free speech, no freedom of expression. Corruption is rampant in all areas. From low-level bureaucrats to high-ranking officials, every civil servant is very skillful in using bribes in their operations.
Well, you don't need to be a genius to work out that that was Russian TV with the Russian accent for the translation there. Martin, what do you make of what he had to say?
Well, I think it's a window opening, isn't it? A crack on what goes on in Saudi Arabia, and as I said earlier on, there's 30,000 political prisoners in Saudi Arabia, and of course the real problem for the Western powers is that the oil fields and most of the oil workers in the eastern part of Saudi Arabia, right next to Bahrain, most of those people are in fact Shia. They're not a majority in Saudi Arabia, but they are a majority of oil workers. So you could envisage a situation where Bahrain and the province of Saudi Arabia that is closest to Bahrain becomes an independent Shia republic with all the oil. You can see the Saudi royal family wouldn't like that idea, and nor would the Americans.
Now, at the heart of a lot of this, of course, is the Israel-Palestine conflict, which we mentioned just now about the Gaza crossing. Martin, Israel has approved 900 new settler homes on the eve of the peace talks. Long-awaited resumption of Israeli-Palestinian peace talks was threatened with collapse after Israel approved the building of 900 new homes for Jewish settlers in East Jerusalem, the latest in a wave of construction plans that's inflamed tensions ahead of the fragile negotiations. And also they are threatening to bring in a new law which will mean they can simply requisition Arab land in East Jerusalem.
Well, it's a way of the right wing in Israel sabotaging any kind of peaceful negotiation.
Is the right wing completely in control in Israel?
Not completely, but I mean...
Well, how have they got this through then?
Well, because the right wing are running the government in Israel, and by bringing forward this settlement plan, they undermine completely any negotiation. But don't forget, the Palestinian Authority is itself not representative. The last democratic election in Palestine was run by Hamas, who are in alliance with the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, in fact. But they're not talking to them at all. So it's just a big joke.
Okay, before we completely finish with the Middle East, though, we can't not mention Bahrain. I mean, you mentioned it a little bit earlier on, but hunting humans in Bahrain with shotguns. On the Before It's News website, some incredible photographs of demonstrators in Bahrain having been peppered by shotgun pellets with... we're not talking about rubber bullets and things. We're talking about a shell containing tens of steel pellets that can easily penetrate bodies from 50 metres, and they're shot at humans from 3 metres, Martin.
Well, the level of violence in Bahrain, proportionate to the size of the population, is every bit as bad as in Syria or Libya. And in Syria and Libya, the Western powers said that the ordinary folk were justified in taking up arms against the government. Perhaps the people in Bahrain would be justified. They wouldn't be wise, but they would be justified. And of course, once we're talking about warfare, that means that the allies of the Bahraini government, and Bahrain was a British colony till 1971, so if I was a Bahraini patriot, I might start thinking, well, it's about time we tried to kill somebody like David Cameron, isn't it?
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
Now, zero-hours contracts. Over the last month, we've seen the government backtracking, raising the number of people they thought were on these contracts from around about 150,000 to over a million. Can we entrust these employment statistics? I think the answer is pretty obvious. It's a no. But what are your legal rights? I'm joined by Will Stone from Avon and Bristol Law Centre. Hi, Will. Welcome to Drive Time. Now, first of all, what about these zero-hour contracts? How have they started to find their way into the employment market? Have they been around for a while?
They have been around for a while. I mean, when I first came across them a few years ago, people calling me on the Law Centre's employment advice line, it tended to be around agency workers. And I was a bit surprised when I first saw a 0 hours contract, because it didn't seem to kind of make much sense. But if you do a quick search, you get to Wikipedia says about 0 hours contracts, that now they seem to be being used by everybody. We know about the criticism that's been made of Amazon. We also know about criticism that's been made of Sports Direct. But other employers that are allegedly use 0 hours contracts are McDonald's. 90% of McDonald's workforce are on 0 hours contract. Subway, and even Buckingham Palace, which employs 350 seasonal summer workers, also uses 0 hours contracts.
Well, we heard on our sister show earlier this afternoon from Jason Yannakopoulos and Private Eye, I think he had a copy of, he was waving around, that even The Guardian on their web desk was using 0 hour contracts.
It doesn't surprise me.
Whilst one part of The Guardian was criticising them, the other part of The Guardian was using them.
Exactly, and I did a quick search yesterday to try and find, I wanted to find some examples of 0 hours contracts so that we could speak about that. And I got through to the website of the Voluntary and Community Action for London, who had a model 0 hours contract, which is designed presumably for use by small charities, community groups. So even small charities, community groups seem to be being encouraged now to put their workers on 0 hours contracts. And I can see from employers' point of view, it makes absolute sense, particularly if you're in the contract and procurement sort of market, where you might be a small company that is doing public service work that's been subcontracted to you by another company that's bid and got the tender to do the job. You want to have some sort of assurance that if needs be, you can just walk away from that contract and not be stuck with a huge liability to pay lots of workers their wages.
Okay, yeah, you've brought along Carol with you. Hi, Carol. Welcome to Drive Time. That's not your real name, but anyway, what can you give us an idea of what? Sorry, would you like to introduce her, Will?
Yeah, this is Carol, who has some experience of 0 hours contracts.
Okay, Carol, can you give us an idea then? No? Okay, well, maybe you would like to say something for her, Will.
Well, I mean, I've got an example of 0 hours contract here, and what it says essentially is you will be expected to be available for work within these hours, and the hours given are 9 to 6 Monday to Friday, although the organisation cannot guarantee the number of hours of excuse me, of work that will be offered. So essentially an employee has to make themselves available to work on a day, Monday to Friday, however they have no guarantee of actually getting the work. So if they went out and got some work from another source, that they went to another organisation to get the work, they'd technically be in breach of contract.
Okay, what about things like basic stuff like sick pay, holiday pay, or, you know, being given holiday time?
Well, they would be entitled to holiday, but of course if you're not receiving any pay because you haven't been given any particular hours in a particular week, then you wouldn't receive any holiday pay to cover you for that.
And how do people on these contracts, how does that fit with the normal employment rights? Have you got the same employment rights as anybody else?
Well, under a proper written and practiced contract of employment, you would be entitled to around 5 weeks holiday per year. You would take that holiday and you would receive your pay as you normally would do during that week. One of the mechanisms that a lot of people on 0 hours contract tend to get is something called rolled up holiday pay. That's where you're paid your hourly wage, let's say it's £6.50 an hour, and then you get 78% p per hour on top of that in respect of any holiday. That has been declared by the European Court to be unlawful and in breach of the working times regulations, which is part of UK law and which gives all workers the right to paid holiday.
I mean, isn't the fact, though, that many employers will want to use these types of contracts simply because it means that they can pick and choose. They don't have to. Say, for example, there's a slack day. They don't have to have somebody come into work.
We can, but I mean, what you find with the workers is that they feel under an awful lot of pressure to actually to take work that's offered to them. So somebody could be rung on a Sunday night at, say, 10 o'clock and asked if they can come along to the place of work. Maybe they're a care worker, maybe they're a warehouse worker, and go to work the following morning at 7 o'clock. The fear is that if they say no, then they won't be offered any more work. And that is what tends to happen in practice. So employers use it as a way of gauging who are the loyal employees, who are the employees they can rely on, and the workers that will not jump when they are asked to jump tend to be pushed to the sidelines.
Okay, give us an example, not naming names, of the sorts of things that people have been coming to you as an employment lawyer with who have been under these contracts.
Well, people come to me to say that they're owed wages by their employer because they haven't been given any work for the last three or four weeks. I ask them to bring in their contracts. Their contracts say your hours of work are zero. You don't have any hours. And I have to say, well, if you don't work in any particular week, then you are not entitled to any pay. And if your employer just decides to put you to the side and to not offer you any work week after week after week, that's not an unfair dismissal.
I mean, with someone in that situation, would they have to be signing on at the same time?
Well,
because you don't have an income.
Well, according to the type of 0 hours contract that I just read out, you probably wouldn't be able to sign on because you would be expected to be available for work. So you wouldn't be able to go and sign on where you are expected to be actively seeking all other kinds of work. So the two don't really quite sit together.
And what about switching people onto these contracts off of an ordinary contract, one where you actually get paid and you come in a normal, regular basis?
Well, I suppose that technically that could happen. That could happen at any time within the first 2 years of employment because, of course, now, under new rules that came in last year, the unfair dismissal rights don't kick in until you've actually been employed for 2 years. And so, for example, there wouldn't be anything to stop an employer saying, well, after you've been there 6 months or so, that we want to renegotiate the contracts. This is the new contract. It's a 0 hours contract. And if you don't like it, well, we'll just give you your 1 week's notice and goodbye.
Martin, how does this fit in, do you think, with the general pattern of, I mean, I can remember back in, gosh, it was probably the 1950s, reading about this in the oil industry, bringing in things like freelance contracts, temporary contracts for people in the oil industry. This is rolled out right across many parts of the job market now. These zero-hour contracts, it doesn't really sound like much of a deal between the employer and the employee if they don't even have to employ you. They don't have to pay you.
Well, it's very similar to what the dockers used to have to put up with for generations, where they have to turn up at the dock gate every day and they're not sure whether they're going to be paid or not, or put on work that day or not. And of course, if you're any kind of union activist, you're at the back of the queue. I mean, it's just an example of the Victorianisation of the British labour market, isn't it? And of course, ultimately, of course, this actually is all forcing down wages and conditions is actually a fool's game. There's no future in it. As a country, Scandinavian countries like Norway don't tolerate this sort of thing, and nor should we.
Okay, well, where should people go for advice?
Well, they can ring the employment advice line at the Avon and Bristol Law Centre, 0117 916 7727, and the details of when that service is available are on our website, which is www.ablc.org.uk, or just put in a search engine Avon and Bristol Law Centre.
Okay, Will Stone from that very able Avon and Bristol Law Centre at the bottom of Stokes Croft. Thanks very much for joining us again.
BCFM 93.2. Bristol is our community.
Now, who's training Colombia's torturers? Tobias Tayani finishes last week's eye-opening dispatch from the heart of the Colombian jungle. Martin, just remind us, what is going on in Colombia? Who is ruling?
Well, President Santos is currently ruling Colombia. He is an elected presidents, but the elections are not entirely free and fair in the sense that if you stand against, if you stand for radical parties, you end up dead before election day.
Okay,
well, there's been a fight going on between them and the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia for 50 years, but a negotiation is now going on between the two sides to try and bring a peace process about.
Okay, well, let's hear the final part of Tobias Tayani's report from the heart of the Colombian jungle.
The Chinese government have bought the rivers there. Sadly, there's a bit of collateral because there are Indians and indigenous who live in this river, on these river basins. But obviously, the Colombian government have all the infrastructure, military infrastructure, to get rid of these pesky Indians who just happen to be on these on the land of the Chinese now. And they have seven dams to be constructed. One has been constructed. In that construction, they found in the river basin gold. And obviously, because the China are in the river, it's now... Actually, I don't think it was China, that company. It's a Spanish company. But because they own the river basin, that company now own that gold, even though it's Colombian heritage. There's another one that's now being passed. And just by these two alone, 80% of the fishing industry there in this great river has been destroyed. That the land, because you get this reservoir, you get the sun reflecting on the hills, and so the land is drying out. As well as drying up on the surface, it's been lubricated by the lake, so you're getting massive landslides. You're getting the land drying out. All the local indigenous crops in this area are failing. But that's all okay with big business, because they've already had a solution that's been in place for many years. In a company called Bienestar, in Spanish that means well-being. It happens to be a sister company of Monsanto, which in the Latin you could say is My Saint. So My Saint and well-being have come into Colombia, and they're offering... their seeds, they're offering agricultural expertise to the Colombian and the country folk and the farmers who've been doing this for thousands of years. They've come there with the solutions, and it's very strange when you see how far back these rivers were sold. When the civil war began in Colombia against the guerrilla forces after the assassination of Gaitan in 1948, there's been a governmental policy in Colombia of aiming their own weapons, well, not their weapons, it's US weapons, at the Colombian people. And for all that time, the Colombian people have been the target of this civil war campaign, because a guerrilla is not going to go around wearing a badge saying, I'm a part of, you know, the revolutionary guerrilla forces. That guerrilla is obviously going to try and look like a civilian. And for that reason, basically the Colombian people themselves, for the last 65 years, have been... they're the enemy of the state. I've had their guns pointed at them. You go there as a tourist nowadays, you know, the government, the army, better said, will pull a bus over, they'll have guns at everyone, and you as a tourist will walk off the bus, and suddenly they'll put the gun down, they'll have a smile, ask you if you're a tourist. Even though I'm not, I say yes, and they're like, great, good, you're a tourist, good. And then with their own people, they're trained to look at their own people like the enemy. And obviously, after 6 years of this, and this is many generations, the people themselves have been trained just to be the suspect. So in terms of, there is no recent development of this, that this system of control has been going on for 60 years. And really, what's been going on there, what everything I've described, is what's happened here in Great Britain centuries ago, with even before the Civil War, with the witch hunts, and everything leading up to that what we're seeing there is kind of what happened here many centuries ago. They've gotten a bit better at this process and can do it a lot faster and better technology to do it. The United States, we know, are supplying the weapons. That is obvious. You go there and you can see on all the army people there what it says. There's a documentary out that I recommend everyone who's interested in this subject to watch. It's called Impunity. This documentary is specifically talking about the paramilitary forces there. And I believe in this documentary you can see that, and there it explains very clearly who does the training there. Israel send some of their best recruits, their best trainers to go there and teach the paramilitary forces how to torture, how to get up confessions, and really it goes a lot more beyond that.
If people want to find out more about Colombia, is there a good place that people can go to online, or are there good little bits of history, books, and, you know, you obviously learnt a lot from the people you've been staying with, but I mean, where's a good place to start?
Well, this documentary I mentioned earlier called Impunity, which is the story of the paramilitary death squads. I'm not sure if it's in English subtitles just yet,
but I recommend this documentary for everyone to have it copied, to have it shown. It's not necessarily one you want to see before going to bed. You want to be seeing it. It's better to see this and have a bit of time to digest it, because it does show very graphic images, and it does show the situation that has gone on there, and that explains very well the plight of actual just the everyday Colombian person there, and why the tourist industry has not flourished there in Colombia.
Now, it does seem as if Latin America has had a pretty hard time ever since really the Second World War. I mean, we know, don't we, that there were Nazi rallies going on in Argentina during the war.
Mm-hmm. That's right, there is a big contingent there and a big connection between the fascism that came up in Chile and Argentina, and also the introduction or the fleeing of Nazi war criminals to South America. But you have to remember that also Nazi war criminals were invited to North America as well. And you have to also remember that the same North America are the ones that funded these regimes in South America. But there are certain anomalies there and certain things that don't make sense. For instance, one of the biggest places is Porto Alegre in Brazil, which has an amazing amount of Nazis that have gone there. And it's also one of the most highly developed, ecological, sustainable towns on the earth. So there is a certain amount of anomalies there, things that don't really fit in to our perception of what we understand of history. And they're very much the agenda there with UNESCO, that is that the earth is more important than the human being. I mean, obviously the earth is bigger than the human being, it has more, you know, without the earth we cannot exist. But the idea that we ourselves can kick another human being down in order to save the earth, we are seriously misunderstanding what it is to live as brothers and sisters on this planet, and not putting each other down just because our idea might be better than someone else's idea. We all have the right to live on this earth in peace.
Tomás Tejani there, from the heart of the Colombian jungle, just back about 2 weeks ago. Time to sign off now. Next up is Cyrus the Virus, the typical topical Afro-tropical show. Thanks very much to our guest in the first hour, Bristol's Cabinet Member for Children, Young People and Education, and Labour Councillor for South Mead, Brenda Massey. Also to Will Stone from Avon and Bristol Law Centre and local author on the effects of depleted uranium, Joanne Baker. Thanks also, of course, to our old Labour Oxford economist, Martin Summers. Thisweek.org.uk takes you straight to this show and our archives, and you can follow me on Twitter at Tony Gosling. And don't let the banksters get you down. See you next week.
Mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.